From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Soon, four will go down to two before Monday's winnowing to one ahead on Only a Game, a men's Final Four preview with Pat Forty. Also, John McCain pushes for a presidential pardon for heavyweight boxer Jack Johnson, and a conversation with Jeff Perlman, author of The Rocket That Fell to Earth, Roger Clemens, and the Rage for Baseball Immortality. Also ahead, New York baseball fans get lost in the Great Gotham Expensive Seat Shuffle.
In 1998, my four-season tickets cost $11,340. If I had renewed the tickets, they would have been $56,000 for a location not as good. I think they're really playing us all for suckers.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. They started out with 64, well, really 65, and now it's down to four, and each of them is set to strive for basketball supremacy. On Monday, one will soar, but that's for then. So now, let's talk about the Final Four. With ESPN's Pat Forty, who is also Only a Game's men's college basketball guy. Pat, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be here.
In today's first semifinal game, Michigan State will take on UConn. Tell me about which players we should be watching as that game unfolds.
Go with the big man. Obviously, Hashim Tabeet for Connecticut, a dominant defensive force, 7'3", just a slight bit shorter than the Empire State Building, I believe. and he's going up against Goran Sutan, who's really emerged for Michigan State. Immigrated with his parents from Bosnia during the war in the 1990s, played high school basketball at Magic Johnson's High School in Lansing, Michigan, and really was never much of a shooter when he got to Michigan State. He'd not taken a three-pointer either of his first two seasons. He made two as a junior, started shooting a few more this year, but then all of a sudden, when they're playing Louisville in the regional final, he made three three-pointers in the first half. Morphed into Pete Maravich out there, and there's I think a school of thought that he will be real trouble for Connecticut's big men to beat and Jeff Adrian by dragging them away from the basket with his shooting threat.
Huskies players have said that the ongoing controversy over possible recruiting violations at Connecticut has not affected them as they have advanced through the tournament. Will that continue to be the case?
I think so. You know, I mean, there's no tangible threat to this team or these players. You know, nobody involved in those allegations is in uniform for them. So, you know, I think that they're basically viewing this as Coach Calhoun's problem. And the players, you know, are just free to play. And I think, you know, some of them actually have a little bit of a chip on the shoulder about it, that, you know, people are out to get them at a time when they're trying to concentrate on the tournament. But, you know, if they're using that for motivation, that's fine. But really, they've played very impressively, I think, throughout most of this tournament, and don't look like they've been bothered by any outside distractions, if you will.
Michigan State has just celebrated the 30th anniversary of that 1979 championship. You mentioned Magic Johnson, of course, in another context. Do you think the 2009 Michigan State squad has a sense of history that will help them out?
Oh, I think, you know what, they do have a sense of history. For one thing, Magic Johnson's around. You know, he's been with the team. He was on the court after they won the regional final. And Tom Izzo, I think, is a great appreciator of the history and tradition of that program and tries to keep that alive whenever he can. In fact, heck, I mean, really, it's been around all season, Bill. I was at their Midnight Madness, and the whole theme was 1979 and you know, the 30th anniversary of that championship. So, you know, I think that they're well aware of that, and it's kind of been with them karmically throughout the year.
In tonight's semifinal, Villanova will try to stun North Carolina, and that would be stunning if it happened that way, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yes. That would be a stunner. Now, I'm not discounting Villanova's chance to play close with North Carolina, but I think a victory would be an epic one.
Pat, I have to ask you about the goings-on in your home state. The University of Kentucky hired former Memphis coach John Calipari to be its new head coach. Is this a wise choice for the school and, for that matter, for Mr. Calipari?
Well, it's certainly an inconsistent choice for the school because 2 years ago when the job was open, they had no interest in John Calipari, and John Calipari wanted the job. But they told people behind the scenes that they had concerns about Calipari and the way he did business. And now, all of a sudden, 2 years later, when you are a more desperate program, desperate to win and desperate to get somebody in charge there who has a big wattage personality, then, geez, they seem to be able to overlook any problems that John Calipari has had. So, you know, it's a remarkable bit of situational ethics, I think, by Kentucky. If I were John Calipari, yes, I would take the job, absolutely. They've made him the richest coach in college basketball history at a program that's going to give him every single opportunity to succeed on the highest level. So, you know, as long as things don't get squirrely off the court, it's a great fit.
Do you think John Calipari is thinking to himself these days, gee, it's a good thing my Memphis team lost as early as it did in the tournament, or I might not have gotten this really cool new job?
You know, I'm sure that's crossed his mind. I mean, if they're still playing, Kentucky's probably looking elsewhere. And sometimes, you know, at least for his personal sake, this that loss to Missouri worked out awfully well for him.
Okay, Pat, it's time for you to go on the record, as all our analysts eventually have to do. Who wins today, and then what happens on Monday?
You know what? I think gigantism wins today. I think UConn and their 7'3" center and Carolina and their 100-foot-tall tradition win out, and I think that it's a Huskies-Tar Heels final. And at that point, I'll take North Carolina. But that should be an epic one, one of those games that you're looking forward to, and it looks great on paper and hopefully lives up to it in person.
Pat Forte writes about sports for ESPN. He joined me on the line from Detroit, the site of the 2009 Men's Final Four. Pat, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill. Enjoy the games.
This is the second time we've done this. We're not going to do it again, because this time we're going to succeed. We're going to get it done. We're going to get the pardon for Jack Johnson and correct one of the great injustices in the past history of this country.
At a Wednesday news conference on Capitol Hill, Senator John McCain of Arizona once again made the case for a presidential pardon for former heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson.
We need to erase this act of racism that sent an American citizen to prison on a trumped-up charge because he happened to be the world champion heavyweight boxer and the first African-American ever to ever achieve that status.
Jack Johnson won the heavyweight championship in 1908 by battering Tommy Burns in a fight in Australia. In 1913, Johnson was convicted of violating the Mann Act, which prohibited the transportation of women across a state line for immoral purposes. Johnson was targeted in part because of his celebrity and because the racist clamor for a great white hope to dethrone Johnson had failed utterly. Beyond that, Johnson himself was no racist. He developed his intimate relationships without regard to race, creed, or color. Johnson was convicted and eventually served 10 months in federal prison. The judge who presided over his trial acknowledged that he wanted to, quote, send a message to black men about relationships with white women. Jack Johnson continued to hold the heavyweight championship until 1915, when he lost the title to Jess Willard. But as Congressman Peter King of New York pointed out during Wednesday's press conference, the persecution of the champion did not end when he was released from prison.
What happened to him was an injustice. The conviction was an injustice. The fact that he was hounded for so many years, even after he was out of prison, is a terrible injustice. Justice delayed is justice denied, but the granting of the pardon will be a retroactive establishment of justice for a great heavyweight champion.
Among those who agree with that assertion is Christopher Rivers, a professor of French at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Massachusetts. He translated Johnson's memoir from the French and has written extensively about the former champion.
I mean, this is something that is so long overdue, and he was so clearly a victim of racism in this case. The charges were so specious that it's really kind of hard for me to imagine that there would be any resistance whatsoever, at least in the past 40 years. But I think this is a particularly propitious moment for this to be happening because President Obama is in office. And I know Obama is a great admirer of Muhammad Ali, and Ali has been very explicit about his debt to Jack Johnson. So there's a chain, and it makes a lot of sense.
Jack Johnson died in an automobile accident in 1946 at the age of 68. His story was retold in Unforgivable Blackness, a 2005 documentary directed by Ken Burns. The director, who was present at Wednesday's news conference, said that the pardoning of Jack Johnson would have implications far beyond the vindication of the individual fighter.
This is not really a question of color. This is a question of justice. Our justice is blind, and it is colorblind. We do this today, not only for Jack Johnson and his memory, not only to give solace to his long aggrieved family, we do it for ourselves.
Several members of Jack Johnson's extended family attended the press conference. Linda Haywood, Jack Johnson's great-great-niece, spoke of the various challenges the champion had faced.
The fact that he lived his own life without explanation and our apology, they didn't like that. You know, even some black people didn't like it because they thought he was uppity, and Caucasian people didn't like it because what business do you have of being rich and driving cars that we can't afford? And so it was the mindset back at the time. And this is one of the reasons that our family was so ashamed and embarrassed, because it was nothing we could do about it. Because back then, if you were told that this is what you did, then you had to accept that. It was no recourse. It was no recourse.
For the members of his family, Jack Johnson is more than a symbol. He is a proud presence. And for Dorothy Cross, Linda Haywood's mother and Jack Johnson's oldest living relative, a champion outside the ring whose public vindication has already begun.
Glad. I'm proud. I'm proud of it. A lot of blacks have been persecuted and misused and abused. You ever heard of the famous words that Martin Luther King said? Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. And he's free. And I am very proud. I am.
At one point in Wednesday's press conference, Senator McCain spoke about the fate of his 2008 attempt to convince George W. Bush to pardon Jack Johnson.
It mainly got bogged down because of bureaucratic inertia, and it's inexcusable. And I also got involved in some other pursuits. I think it's important to be done. I think that it will be an expression in some ways of that we have come a long ways from those days. But frankly, the things that were done to Jack Johnson will remain an unhappy chapter in America's history.
Senator McCain believes he'll be more successful on Jack Johnson's behalf this time around. Professor Rivers believes the time is right for that success.
I think these are very significant moments when a culture or a country can go back and say, we did something wrong, and even though it's too little too late and it doesn't do anything for Jack Johnson himself, we are acknowledging the fact that this was wrong and should never have happened. And I think there's great healing and great symbolic importance in those gestures.
Professor Rivers, Senator McCain, Linda Haywood, and Dorothy Cross, among many others, will now await action by the House and the Senate, and, assuming those actions are positive, a decision by President Obama. It's 19 minutes past the hour. At sports events, mascots are supposed to encourage fans to cheer for their teams. Wearing gigantic smiling heads, which are often fuzzy, they are supposed to delight youngsters who might otherwise become bored. They are not supposed to deck each other. But during a Western Athletic Conference tournament basketball game last month, Big Blue, the Utah State Ox, pulled off the mustache that had been attached to Pistol Pete, the mascot representing New Mexico State. Pete responded by jumping on Big Blue's back and trying to wrestle him to the ground and choke him. Both mascots were suspended, and Pistol Pete was encouraged by New Mexico State Athletic Director McKinley Boston to regard the episode as a learning experience.
Hear my song as I ride along. I'm just a happy rolling cowboy. Herding the dark clouds out of the sky. Keeping the heaven.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, New York, New York. New stadium, new stadium. But first, I'm joined by ESPN's Tim Kirkchen for his take on which Major League Baseball teams need more spring training and which ones are ready for the regular season, which begins on Monday. He joins me now from the new Yankee Stadium in New York. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be be here, Bill.
In the Arizona camp of the San Diego Padres, Jake Peavy would seem to be ready for the season to begin. After his less than exceptional performance in the World Baseball Classic, he has thrown 14 consecutive scoreless innings in the Cactus League. Do he and the Padres get off to a great start?
No, Bill. This is one of the very, very few things I'm certain about this year. The Padres are not a good team, and they're not going to be a good team at any point this year. And I would be really, really surprised if Jake Peavy were a Padre by the end of the season. I'm sure they're going to keep him through the beginning of the season, but when May rolls around and some teams are looking for a player, looking for a pitcher, he's going to be the first name that comes up because he can bring the Padres three players back that they really need at this point. And he's making $11 million this year and is owed $64 million on his contract. Padres have just been sold. They're trying to save some money. So the most logical thing to do is when summer approaches, trade Jake Peavy. Not because he's good. He's great. But he could really help somebody. And by dealing him, I think that's the best way for the Padres to start to get better.
In the waning days of spring training, the Detroit Tigers decided to release Gary Sheffield, who is just one home run shy of 500. The Tigers had to eat $14 million remaining on Sheffield's contract to rid themselves of him. They must really think he can't play anymore.
Well, I was there the day he got released. I just happened to walk in the clubhouse 5 minutes before they released him. And their thinking is this: we need to move him along, put a younger guy in that spot, and free up the DH for other guys who are going to need a day off from their position, and they could take a day off and we wouldn't lose their bat at the DH. He's going to sign with the New York Mets. I think if he fills in and right one day, left field the next day, I think he'll hit more than one home run because he hit 19 last year and just over 400 at bats, but it just wasn't the same Gary Sheffield we're used to seeing.
No team has spent more money to re-equip itself than the Yankees have. This is the kind of thing you could say almost every year. But how many games do they have to lose in April for manager Joe Girardi to be fired?
I think he's going to get a break in April because Alex Rodriguez won't be here in April, and he's going to need a good month to figure out what he's got, where he's going to put everybody, that type of thing. So I think he'll get a grace period. However, if he's into June and they're under 500 in a new ballpark, having spent $482 million on free agents and $1.5 billion on a new ballpark, and they didn't make the playoffs last year in his first year, I'm not sure he'll make it to the All-Star break if they're stumbling.
Tim, as we speak, you are in the press box at Yankee Stadium, the new Yankee Stadium. Give us your impressions of this marvelous, albeit marvelously expensive monument.
It looks a lot like the old Yankee Stadium, which is a good thing. I mean, it's got the same facade on the top of the upper deck. It looks exactly like the old stadium in that respect. Same blue seats. Monument Park is a little different. I'm looking at that right now, and it's a bit off. In other words, it doesn't have its own special area yet. But everything else looks a lot the same. From the outside, it's just opulent beyond belief, and it is a beautiful, beautiful structure. And most important for the players, believe it or not, the clubhouse facilities are completely different. They're enormous. You know, there was nothing worse than going into the Yankee visiting clubhouse after a big game with 6,000 media people in there. You couldn't even breathe. Now at least we're done with that. And anything that makes it easier for the media, I'm all for that.
Tim, I have looked over the experts' picks for this season, or the picks of some of the experts at least, and there are disagreements, of course, except with regard to the American League West, where everybody connected with Sports Illustrated thinks the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, or whatever they're calling themselves this season, will finish first. Are they right?
I think they're right. I'm picking the Angels first also, which, of course, doesn't mean much coming from me, as I've acknowledged many times on this show. But keep in mind, Bill, three-fifths of their starting rotation is going to miss time at the beginning of the season. And two of them, Ervin Santana and John Lackey, are going to probably miss the whole month of April. Plus, they lost Mark Teixeira to free agency. They lost Frankie Rodriguez, their closer, who saved 62 games last year. He plays for the Mets. So it's not that everybody loves the Angels, because I certainly don't. It's that the other teams in the division aren't particularly good.
When we last spoke, Tim, you told me that you thought the Chicago Cubs would not only win the National League Central Division, but also the World Series. Has anything that has happened during March changed your opinion?
No. And I think since I last spoke to you, I had a long talk with Lou Piniella about things, the manager of the Cubs, and he's pretty fired up about things. And, you know, this is a significant point, Bill. They are no longer the lovable little Cubbies that everyone comes to watch and everyone has a great time at the game and they lose and everyone goes home happy. There are some angry people in Chicago right now about the way the Cubs have played in the playoffs the last 2 years. This is unacceptable for them. Lou Piniella knows it. All the players know it. And I think that's how they're going to approach the season, that anything less than a world championship is just not going to be enough.
Tim, I know that Major League Baseball would like to put all the talk about steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs in the past, but the Bonds trial is still news. Nobody knows what's going to happen next with Roger Clemens, so we haven't heard the last of these stories. Who's the hitter most likely to bang out 10 home runs in April and begin hearing catcalls?
Unfortunately, that's going to happen to a lot of people. And it doesn't even matter if you're clean or anything else. When you hit that many homers that early, somebody's going to say, hey, what's going on with this guy? But, you know, we're slowly but surely getting away from that era. And the further, sadly, we get away from Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and Rafael Palmeiro, the better the game is going to be for it. And it is possible 20 years from now that the two leading home run hitters of all time, Barry Bonds and Alex Rodriguez, and five of the top 11, plus the greatest pitcher we've seen in the last 80 years, Roger Clemens, none of those 11 is going to be in the Hall of Fame. That is a possibility. So this story is not going away, and that is really, really unfortunate for the game.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian joins me from time to time to talk Major League Baseball. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
For their exhibition games last night and this afternoon against the Chicago Cubs, the first at their spanking new stadium in the Bronx, the New York Yankees sold some of their bleacher and grandstand seats for 25 cents and $1.10, respectively. That's what it cost when the original Yankee Stadium opened in 1923. But as only a game's Ron Schachter reports, when the Yankees play their first regular season home game in their new digs against Cleveland on April 16th, such nostalgia will be a thing of the past.
With the venerable house that Ruth built looming behind it, the new Yankee Stadium, the mansion that $1.5 billion built, rises within a few feet of the elevated train tracks that have stood here since the early 20th century. Assorted souvenir shops, a family dollar store, and low-budget eateries still operate just across the street. But there's nothing of the old neighborhood in the new Yankees' ticket prices and policies. Inside the stadium, the front row infield seats will cost $2,500 each per game, which is 600 times more expensive than when George Steinbrenner bought the team in the mid-1970s. Of course, you'll need a season ticket to sit in these seats, which brings the grand total to $202,500. And the same full-season requirement holds for the $850, $650, and $525 seats surrounding the infield. As longtime Yankee fan Frank Colagiro waits in line to buy one of the few $14 single-game bleacher seats available for the coming season, he says he's not particularly concerned.
I don't have a problem with it. I don't have to see up close. It doesn't matter.
But while workers put the finishing touches in place for the home opener less than 2 weeks away, there are plenty of fans reeling from ticket shock, and Yankee executives have been playing more defense than their all-star infield. For more than a decade, Marion Falcone and a group of friends have held infield seats to about a dozen games a year. Falcone says the Yankees threw them a curve this year by relocating partial season ticket holders to the outfield bleachers.
We were actually between the on-deck circle and the Yankee dugout. If we wanted our seats, the original seats, we would have to now pay $100 per ticket, but we would also have to pay for 81 games. None of us could afford that. You know, we're middle-class families just enjoying a baseball game.
The Yankees, who declined to be interviewed, have said that the almost 5,000 highest price seats make the remaining 47,000 more affordable. And they do have to pay the debt service on the new stadium, not to mention their $400 million off-season spending spree on free agent pitchers CeCe Sabathia and A.J. Burnett and first baseman Mark Teixeira. and they still owe almost $250 million to third baseman Alex Rodriguez over the next 9 years. Still, Falcone, who works as the office manager for a financial services firm, says the Yankees' ticket policies are exacting too high a price.
I don't think that's fair to the loyal fans. And not just me, that's everyone. You know, even the bleacher creatures were basically moved out. They were not renewed.
The Mets haven't been immune to fan reactions either. As the team moves into $800 million Citi Field in neighboring Queens, they'll do so without fans like real estate developer Lee Livingston, whose family has had full-season box seats for the past 45 years and who just said no to this year's price increases.
In 1998, my four-season tickets cost $11,340. If I had renewed the tickets, they would have been $56,000 for a location not as good at Citi Field. I think all these teams, be it baseball and basketball and hockey, I think they're really playing us all for suckers. I think they're really playing us all for suckers.
New York Post sports columnist Phil Mushnick warns that fans of the Mets and Yankees, as well as the Giants football team, whose season ticket holders will pay as much as $20,000 for seat licenses in the new Meadowlands Stadium scheduled to open next year in New Jersey, are reaching their tipping points.
It's become, you know, economic Darwinism, survival of the wealthiest. But the problem is the wealthiest aren't necessarily the stupidest. If you're suddenly asked in the middle of a recession for $80,000 just to renew the right to buy your four tickets that have been in your family and you've supported this team, say the New York Giants, for three generations, it becomes easy to say no.
Even the New York State Assembly is paying attention. Brian Kavanaugh, who represents Manhattan's East Side, has introduced legislation mandating that 7% of the seats at sports events in the state be available at affordable prices. Kavanaugh points out that the Yankees are saving millions a year in debt service because they've been allowed to finance their new stadium through tax-free, lower-interest municipal bonds.
People are outraged that these facilities can be constructed with enormous subsidies from the public without any concern for whether there's a public benefit. At the end of the day, if we're going to build the most expensive facilities in the history of the world, we ought to be able to ensure that ordinary people can participate.
For all of the preseason brouhaha about the Yankees' priciest seats, they have yet to sell them out. The team has hired a prominent New York real estate firm and last month even hosted an open house to find more buyers. Michael Kramer, a sports management professor at New York University and the former president of the Texas Rangers, offers a more modest proposal.
I think what they ought to do is cut the prices back even for the ones that have already paid. And quite frankly, maybe they'll make $10 million less than they were going to make. That will buy the loyalty long term.
Kramer adds that with the exception of the new Dallas Cowboys Stadium, with its seat licenses reaching $150,000, the more stratospheric costs to sports fans are largely confined to the greater New York area. Still, the best seats at the Metropolitan Opera, another local institution, top out at $650 per seat. So how can the Yankees charge New Yorkers four times more to see A-Rod swing than to watch the proverbial fat lady sing? To that question, Kramer channels the mighty Babe himself. Maybe the Yankees had a better year. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're listening to Only a Game. On our show 2 weeks ago, Only a Game's Karen Given reported on the women's ice hockey team from Mercyhurst College after they upset Minnesota in the semifinals of the Frozen Four. This delighted Max Spencer, a WBUR listener who wrote, "Fabulous report on Mercyhurst. I have no connection with the team, but they were fantastic, and your reporter reported superbly." Brian Drum, who listens to the Only a Game podcast, also emailed this week, "I enjoy your program with its emphasis on offbeat and otherwise underreported sports," he wrote, "though I might as well tell you I'm never going to like soccer much. In last week's program, I was pleased to get the expected respite from men's March Madness. In two separate segments, you mentioned Pat Summitt's early exit from the women's tournament, but the name of the school that showed Tennessee the door was never mentioned. That school happened to be my alma mater, Ball State University." Another listener who downloads the podcast wrote to respond to last week's program, which included a story about UConn men's coach Jim Calhoun and my commentary about the relationship between Division I sports teams and the universities where they are housed. "Two things made me laugh during this week's show," wrote Anonymous. Must be of Greek extraction. Anyway, he or she wrote, "First, a student athlete is taking the year to focus on academics, which is clearly a euphemism for academically ineligible. Second was the idea that student athletes aren't learning to enjoy learning and that college is supposed to help make people lifelong learners. For most students, college is a means to an end, a good job. Many students, not just student athletes, leave college without a love of learning and reading." True, certainly, Anonymous, but no less regrettable for that, I think. Ron Hartnett, who has himself written a book about umpiring, appreciated my conversation on last week's program with Bruce Weber about his book, As They See 'Em, A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires. "I really enjoyed that interview," Mr. Hartnett wrote. "Umpires, whether pro or amateur, need to have their status elevated." You can email us with similar encouragement or a scathing rebuttal by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can write us at onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decordova Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decordova.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The relationship between trading cards and investing took a perverse turn this week when the Topps Company, long one of the makers of the sports cards some collect in the hope that their value will appreciate, announced a new line of merchandise. Topps will be offering cards based on the world's biggest hoaxes, hoodwinks, and bamboozles. You can collect the images of Enron's former bosses, Charles Ponzi, and, yes, Bernard Madoff, the former NASDAQ chairman who last month pleaded guilty to securities fraud and perjury. Mr. Madoff's scams relieved his investors of billions of dollars and crippled the efforts of various charitable institutions. So, whereas buying his card as an investment might be an uncertain proposition, it can't possibly be a worse idea than was trusting him. The name of the place is Cheater's Heaven. The name of the place. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, SI writer Jeff Perlman plays a little chin music for Roger Clemens. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look at the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
It is semifinal semi-madness today in Detroit. First game, Michigan State, UConn. Second game, Villanova against North Carolina. Who wins?
I think North Carolina is going to beat Villanova because I'm going to stay with North Carolina, pick them at the beginning of the year. There's no reason to change now. Michigan State and Connecticut. I hope Connecticut wins because the kind of ball Michigan State will have to play to win that game is going to want me to stick needles in my eyes. So I don't care really who's in the finals, except I just assume Michigan State not be there.
Memphis was eliminated by Missouri in the regional semifinals, not long after which head coach John Calipari signed on at Kentucky for $31.65 million over the next 8 years. So do we immediately pencil in Kentucky as a Final Four team in, say, 2010?
Oh, they're going to win. There's no question about it. The question is how they do it, of course. And if I was the University of Kentucky, I would hope that I got my money's worth on this contract in the first 3 or 4 years, because I have a feeling that the University of Kentucky program is going to be riding every ride at deposition land sooner or later.
UConn,
this is an enormous amount of money for a guy whose track record is, shall we say, spotty.
UConn head coach Jim Calhoun recently bristled at a reporter's questions about his salary. He presides over a program that, according to the Connecticut legislature, earned a little over $14 million last year. The program costs almost $8 million a year to run. So is the coach being overpaid at $1.6 million a year?
Well, I imagine how much money they'd make if they didn't have to pay for all those cell phone calls to street agents. Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
why
we
would
brought
I say
that up in
why,
the Final Four.
Why would I say that this time this weekend?
It's just awful.
Anyway, this is one of the things you get when you have a state-run university running one of these programs, is you have to actually show the money. So,
of course, the other thing is, didn't they forget to factor in labor costs for the players?
Well, we don't know that. We know that players at most major basketball schools get only books, fees, tuition, room, and board. And then we all know that we're going to take a unicorn and go to the circus this week. Carry on.
Who do you like in tomorrow's women's semifinals?
You're kidding, right? They should just play a doubleheader, let UConn win both games by 90 points, and end this thing in one day.
Give them the championship for the next several years.
I mean, boy, is that team good. Cal Berkeley was actually ahead in that game, and they were ahead in that game or competitive in that game for a long time. By the end of the game, they looked like they weren't even on the floor. UConn is a startlingly good basketball team this year.
Oklahoma, one of the other teams in the Final Four, is led by Courtney Paris, who this week became the first four-time All-American in women's college basketball. But any doubt that in 2 years, sophomore Maya Moore of Connecticut will become the second woman to achieve that distinction?
Absent a really bad knee injury or a sudden desire to join the poor Clares. This is surprising to me. I would have thought there was at least one other four-time. I mean, Diana Taurasi, Rebecca Lobo, somebody. This is very surprising to me, and good for Courtney Paris, and I hope they let her keep her scholarship.
This week, Yankees general partner Hal Steinbrenner admitted that some seats at the New York Yankee Stadium may be overpriced.
No!
I'm sorry, I can't say that with a straight face. It was also learned that Bernard Madoff seats at Citi Field may be available. So can you believe nothing but deals, deals, deals down in New York City?
All right, first thing, thanks, Hal. Really.
You think?
Thank you for telling me that the premium Legend Suite seats that they opened up for sale 13 months ago and sold them from between $500 and $2,500 might be somewhat overpriced. Really? Unless they dig up the Legend themselves and park them in the seat next to you, yes, they're overpriced. But if I'm going to bid on Bernie Madoff's seat, you know what the first thing I'm doing? I'm looking underneath it, because there's lots of money there.
Somewhere. After weeks of hearing quarterback Jay Cutler complain about being put on the trading block, the Broncos finally did trade him. Do you think Cutler knows he's been traded from the fourth-rated passing offense to the Chicago Bears, who rank 29th in that category?
The point is, obviously, that he will raise that somewhere into the mid-teens probably by the next year. I'm just amused by the constant vilification of Jay Cutler by the He-Man Football Writers Association Club. You know what? This is the only way he could get out. He got out. The labor agreement that under which professional football players labor is a joke, but it isn't worthy of the name labor agreement. And the notion that I have to feel bad for Pat Bowlen because Jay Cutler didn't return his phone calls is ludicrous. I don't care about any of the greedy sons of guns who runs these teams. I really don't.
Michael Vick told a judge in bankruptcy court that he will work a $10 an hour construction job when he gets out of prison. Should he be talking to the Denver Broncos about their starting quarterback job instead?
I think that the construction job is a good way back into the world for him. I don't think he's going to wind up in Denver. I wouldn't be entirely surprised if Michael Vick wound up a running back somewhere.
Last week, the Illinois Senate guaranteed $250 million to the IOC in hopes that they will land the 2016 Summer Games. On Thursday, Chicagoans protested as members of the IOC arrived in town. I guess they don't believe the claim that the games could pump $22.5 billion into the Illinois economy and create 315,000 jobs.
No, of course they don't, because it isn't going to do that. And frankly, they're never going to have to dip into this $250 million because they've got less chance of getting the Olympics than I have of getting them in my backyard.
That would be cool.
It would be cool, but I would have no idea where to put the equestrian.
You know, this 315,000 job deal, what good is 315,000 jobs that last 3 weeks?
Well, actually, some of them last as long as a year to build the various overpriced stadiums that will be laying fallow by 2019.
An Olympics of sorts staged in New York on Tuesday was run on a somewhat more modest budget than the Chicago Games would require. Are you sorry that you missed the unemployment Olympics?
I'm glad I don't qualify for the unemployment Olympics
Just be patient.
They were at Tompkins Square Park in the East Village. They threw telephones around. They beat up pinatas. They played a thing called Pin the Blame on the Boss.
Excellent.
I mean, it's not Eugene V. Debs and it's not Bill Haywood, but at least it's something, you know?
And finally, more evidence of hard times for athletes.
Just inches from a clean
getaway. Yes, this evidence comes from France, where Romain Mesnil, who won a silver medal in pole vaulting at the 2007 Athletics World Championships in Osaka, has come up with a very creative way to deal with the loss of his Nike sponsorship, and I just don't know whether it'll strike you as a good idea or not.
Can I just say how dearly, dearly I wish this guy was a hurdler or a hammer thrower or a discus thrower or a sprint guy, anything, so I wouldn't have to say naked pole vaulter running with his pole through the streets. There's no reason for the children to hear that, Bill.
Paris in the spring. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and fully clothed, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
It's all in the plant, Bill.
The last two chapters of Jeff Perlman's new book are titled Credibility Lost and Dead Pitcher Walking, which may give you some idea of the author's take on Roger Clemens. The book is The Rocket That Fell to Earth, Roger Clemens and the Rage for Baseball Immortality, and Jeff Perlman joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Jeff, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it.
It may surprise some of your readers to learn that as a young athlete, Roger Clemens was not especially promising. How did it happen that an overweight adolescent, incapable of throwing hard enough to impress the scouts, became a great young pitcher?
Well, you know, there's a whole backstory to Clemens that's really, you wouldn't think, because, you know, I wrote a book about Barry Bonds years ago, and he was this guy who from age three on was just a supernova. And Clemens, you know, who grew up outside of Dayton, Ohio, in Butler Township, Ohio, as you said, was just a fat little, you know, sort of weeble wobble of a kid who, glad I made you laugh there. And, you know,
weeble wobble was just excellent.
But they never fall down. He moved to Texas midway through high school, arrived at first at Dulles High School where he played JV baseball, then at Spring Woods High School where he was the number three starter as a junior. And then finally as a senior, he was the number one starter. But he still was unimpressive and no one scouted him. The team was, I think, 17-10. So finally the head coach at San Jacinto Junior College, Wayne Graham, who's now at Rice, basically said, all right, we'll take him, and hopefully he won't be terrible. And, in fact, Clemens shows up, and on one of the first days, Wayne Graham's assistant coach says to Wayne Graham, why'd you take the fat kid? That was the actual quote, why'd you take the fat kid? But Graham saw something in Clemens. So Graham tinkered, and Clemens' velocity when he was at San Jacinto went from mid to sort of high-ish 80s to low, approaching mid-90s. And it was at that point, finally, that University of Texas, where Clemens had always dreamed of pitching, showed an interest in him.
John Turner, the student manager of the team at Texas, said of Clemens that, quote, his reason for living was to kick ass in baseball. To what extent does that explain the next 25 years of his life?
I think very well, actually. You know, there's a writer named Pat Jordan who I think is great.
And I agree.
He's written about Clemens a lot. And I actually start off my book with a quote from his book, A Fall Spring, which is one of my favorite books of all time. And the quote is, what would I be without baseball? I could think of nothing. And that's Clemens. I mean, Clemens sees everything, and this is what's gotten him into trouble and probably also what made him a great ball player, is he sees absolutely everything through the prism of baseball. And when I say that, I mean all four of his kids, their first names start with the letter K, symbolizing strikeout. When he buried his mother, Bess, he had her buried in a diamond necklace with 21 diamonds representing his uniform number. When he gives gifts, it would almost always be a signed baseball or a signed picture of himself. He really hoped that Jorge Posada would be his catcher for his 300th game because it would be such a wonderful gift for Jorge Posada. Everything in his life was about baseball, and not just about baseball, but getting into the Hall of Fame. I mean, a few years ago, he had this sort of audacity to say if the Hall did not enter him in as a Yankee wearing a Yankee hat, he probably wouldn't show up. That is definitely not a demand he would make today.
No, I wouldn't think so. In Boston, where Clemens began his major league career, former Red Sox general manager Dan Duquette took a lot of heat for concluding in 1996 that Roger Clemens was, quote, in the twilight of his career. But you write that Dan Duquette was absolutely right. Why?
He was. And I actually called it, it's funny, I call this book tour unofficially the Dan Duquette Redemption Tour. And Dan Duquette wouldn't even talk to me, but It's funny. His last 4 years in Boston, Clemens was a 40-39 pitcher. His velocity was way down. It had fallen from sort of 98-99 to 91-92. He gained weight. He was much more injury prone. And Duquette wisely made the decision that Roger Clemens was approaching over the hill. And we're not going to commit a lot of money to a guy like this who's not going to put up for long term. So Clemens uses this as his great motivation. You know, he says basically says to hell with Boston, and he signs with Toronto as a free agent. And he goes on to win these two Cy Young Awards and have this amazing career where he wins another Cy Young Award with the Yankees, another one with Houston. And much of that, you can't say all of it, but much of it was due to performance enhancers, human growth hormones, steroids, his relationship with Brian McNamee. So Dan Duquette was right, 100% right. You know, 30-year-old pitchers are past their prime unless something fishy is going on or you're Nolan Ryan, and that almost never happens.
Roger Clemens is still denying that he used performance-enhancing drugs, but when you write about Clemens using steroids and human growth hormone, the adjective alleged never appears. Who or what convinced you that he was lying?
A lot of it, talking to former teammates. Most of it, Brian McNamee, and talking with different people associated with McNamee. And, you know, Clemens' side has done a lot to demonize Brian McNamee, and some of it well-justified. But that guy had zero, absolutely zero to gain by making this stuff up. That's the first thing. Zero to gain. I mean, literally, if you're going to lie about this, you're going to jail. Secondly, he was right. You know, he was right about Andy Pettit. He was right about Chuck Knoblauch. He gave information that across the board checked out. This is going to sound weird, but as a baseball writer who's covered the steroid era for whatever, most of my career, I'm sort of tired of saying alleged when it's not alleged. You know, I'm tired of, I know that sounds dumb, but I really am. I'm tired of hearing this, I never failed a drug test, garbage. I can't deal with this anymore. You know, I just can't deal with it anymore. If you use performance enhancers, the lesson here from Jason Giambi, from Andy Pettit is come clean, admit you did it, and you'll be fine. We'll respect you for telling the truth, even if it's late. That's fine. But a guy like Roger Clemens, where it's so incredibly blatant, just like Mark McGwire, I'm not going to use alleged anymore with Mark McGwire. It's obvious. It's blatant. We know he did it. Rafael Palmeiro, I'm not going to use alleged. If Roger Clemens wants to sue me and go back to court debating his usage of performance enhancers, I mean, I would prefer nobody sues me, but it'd probably sell 8 trillion books for me, so I can't, you know. I mean, I just think it's ridiculous. Of course he's not. You know, if Roger Clemens, after all he's gone through, is going to sue someone, you know, he'll have a lot of people besides me to sue.
You, like many other writers and observers, suggest that Roger Clemens did damage to his reputation and his credibility when he appeared before the U.S. Congress. In the research that you did for this book, did you get a sense of why he even decided to do that?
Yeah. You know, his whole thing, from the time he was a kid, winning is everything. Not just everything, it's absolutely everything. You do not lose, you don't surrender, you don't give in. There's no defeat. Defeat is for the weak. You win, period, damn it. Clemens carried that throughout his career, and it worked great for him as a pitcher. Obviously, it worked great for him as a pitcher. But I think when you always think you're going to win, and when you always think you can bully yourself to a victory, I have to think the way he looked at guys like Elijah Cummings and Waxman and, you know, everyone else on the committee was, who are these pencil necks to frickin' stand in my way? You know, there was a point when Waxman made a point to him, and Clemens started countering, and it wasn't really his turn to speak. It's on YouTube. It's great. Mm. And Waxman says very pointedly, you had your time to speak. It's over. And it was the first time I've ever seen Clemens smack down to size. And I thought it was a really sort of profound moment because it just never happened to that guy in his life. I'm sure he thought it wasn't going to happen on that day either, and it did.
Well, you say he has a long history of a couple of things. One is not telling the truth, and the other is somehow being able to convince himself that the lies he tells are the truth. And that comes not only from you, but from several people with whom you spoke.
Yeah, it's weird. One of the first things I read for this book was his autobiography, Rocket Man, which he wrote in 1987 with Peter Gammons.
Mm-hmm.
If you read that book, Roger Clemens was a 22nd round draft pick of the Minnesota Twins out of high school. Not true. If you read that book, University of Georgia and Northeast Louisiana offered him dual football baseball scholarships. Not true. I thought this was going to be my guide. In fact, it really annoys me because I have two letters telling me you made a big error in your book. And the big error is I have that when he was a boy in Ohio, he used to eat Blue Bonnet ice cream on his stepfather's lap in Ohio. And two people wrote to me, they didn't sell that brand of ice cream in Ohio. Well, I got that straight from Roger Clemens' autobiography. I thought it was at least solid that he remembered what kind of ice. If he was that specific about the ice cream, I thought he'd be right about it. And I understand, look, I understand, you know, if you were to interview me tomorrow about my life, there are certain things I would leave out, obviously, and certain things I would want you to highlight. But he's put a lot of things in there that just didn't happen at all.
Given what's happened to various ballplayers who've acknowledged using steroids and human growth hormone, and what's happened to the ballplayers who have denied doing so, what do you anticipate will ultimately happen to Roger Clemens?
You know, if I were a betting man, I'd probably bet that he ends up going to jail for perjury, because I just think the evidence is too strong. You know, McNamee saving the DNA, whether it'll be used or not, there's just too many things against him. And I feel like if you're going to perjure yourself, do it in front of the local town board or something, but don't do it before Congress. It was just one of the dumbest decisions I've ever seen in my life. People say, oh, Rusty Hardin, his lawyer, must be a terrible lawyer. Rusty Hardin has a great reputation in Texas and has done many things well. I just can't believe Roger Clemens was listening to his lawyers. Do you know any lawyer in America who would advise his, you know, here's a great thing you should do, buddy. Lie before Congress. It'll take you far. It's a great idea.
A career move not to be denied.
Right, you know, good luck with that.
Jeff Perlman is the author of The Rocket That Fell to Earth, Roger Clemens and the Rage for Baseball Immortality. The book is published by HarperCollins, and Jeff Perlman joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No, thank you so much.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Brian Fadham and from David Nogueras and from Bart Rankin at WFCR in Amherst. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view photo galleries, past and present, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Dorothy Cross, Jack Johnson's oldest living relative, who remembers visits from her pugilist great-uncle.
Oh, he would pop in, you know. I like that because he's always bringing goodies like money and some old goodies like money.
That's too bad, because when I think goodies, I think brownies, chocolate chip cookies, things of that nature, and money just can't buy those. I'm Bill Littlefield. Actually, money can buy those. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.